The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Back just an hour into New York City in our studios, where you can watch this program by going to progressiveradionetwork.com. We have a full hour. I will try to get your calls in today. I have two guests. A newsmaker guest at the top of the program in a minute will be Professor James Galbraith. We're going to talk about the plummeting of the Dow, the meaning of the S&P downgrade, critique on Obama and Congress, and how much of what we're being told is legitimate and how much is hyperbole and political posturing. Professor James Galbraith is a distinguished professor and chair of the Government and Business Relations at LBJ School of Public Affairs, the University of Texas in Austin. He is the son of the renowned economist John Kenneth Galbraith, and he is the chair of the International Organization's Economist for Peace and Security and a senior scholar at the Levy Economics Institute. In the early 80s, he served on the congressional staff as the executive director of the Joint Economic Committee. He's written many books. His latest is The Predatory State, How Conservatives Abandoned the Free Market and Why Liberals Should Too, which targets the liberal economic policies being espoused by both parties for being bankrupt in theory. And my second guest in the second part of our program will be Eric Wahlberg. We're going to talk about globalization for idiots, how both the Democrats, Republicans, Tea Parties, and most people in the media have not taken the time to actually study in any depth and with any honest sense of scholarship the consequences of neoliberalism policies by the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and what it means to the countries that have received the benefit of their money, structural adjustment, the changing in their economies, privatization of their vital resources that historically had been what kept poor people from falling into abject poverty. So we'll examine that in depth. He is a scholar in international affairs. He is also an investigative journalist and has studied extensively in the sociopolitics of the Middle East, Central Asia, and Russia. And he has lived in the former Soviet Union, modern Russia, Uzbekistan, as a United Nations advisor and lecturer. And he is currently a journalist for Cairo's foremost newspaper, Al Abram, and a frequent contributor to progressive sites like Global Research, Counterpunch, and Dissident Voice. Also today, a look at Japan's latest secrets that have been unveiled, leaving evacuees in peril. I'll go into depth on this, about how the top officials, including the Prime Minister and the head of the utility, knew that the people who were most concerned about the Fukushima meltdown and had moved just a few miles thinking that they were going in the right direction, where the winter winds would be blowing in the opposite direction, were actually wrong. The winds were blowing in their direction, and therefore they were getting the full force in the air and in their food and water from this. The government knew it, chose not to tell them, and as a result, the people now may have been hit with lethal levels, meaning the radiation so high and their children themselves, that you're going to see another type of Chernobyl. As one of them said, quote, withholding the information so we could not move is akin to murder. So we will discuss that. And my commentary today, time permitting, is this. This is from Rania Kalik from Aldernet. 8 years in prison for a simple little harmless prank. A child of six handcuffed for doodling on a desk. What has happened in America is the increasing criminalization of students. And why? What's behind this? That will be our commentary. as you see, plus health and nutrition, we have a lot to share. Let's first go to our newsmaker guest standing by down in Texas, Austin, Texas, Professor James Galbraith. Nice to have you with us today, sir.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Could you please give us the overview from your perspective of what has happened and what we should pay careful attention to, because we can learn something from it, and also separate what we have been led to believe is important but may be misdirected?
And on what subject?
Okay. I'm talking about the.
I know.
Yeah.
The events in the markets and the
yes.
downgrade and so on.
Yes.
The downgrade was a very foolish act by a in many ways discredited company, Standard & Poor's, which had a very bad record in the housing finance debacle, had played a very active role in attempting to in repressing fair lending laws that would have that might have slowed the rush to the issuance of fraudulent securities based upon defective mortgages, and which has in the period since then been attempting to play a political role, pronouncing on what Congress and the President should do. And they said before the debt deal that they would downgrade the United States if the powers that be did not come up with a very large package of cuts in the budget, $4 trillion, which would have entailed substantial cuts, very large cuts in Social Security and Medicare, as well as, to be fair to them, tax increases. And when the actual deficit deal didn't nail down the cuts in Social Security and Medicare, S&P had basically been boxed in by their own threat-making into issuing this downgrade. What they did was to, what the downgrade supposedly means is that there was an estimated increased risk of delayed payments or even failure to repay principal, default, on U.S. government bonds and bills. No such risks exist. The investors of the world quickly demonstrated their view of the matter when on Monday they fled from risky private assets, global stocks generally. And what did they buy? They bought U.S. Treasury bonds and bills and bid up the prices a bit, and the interest rates actually fell rather than rose. So the asset that was alleged to be risky by S&P was shown by the investing community to be what it always has been, the safe haven in a panic and a flight to safety. What was interesting to me about this fracas was the extent to which S&P was really reflecting the mainstream political views in Washington. The idea that there should be a $4 trillion deficit deal was not a freakish right-wing Tea Party idea. It was the idea being advanced by Barack Obama's White House. And so it seems to me one can't really criticize S&P for the basis on which they took this foolish action without pointing out that the entire drive to cut vital social insurance programs, particularly Social Security and Medicare, which are the basic remaining bulwarks that have kept the elderly population of the United States out of poverty, is faulty. And the fact that the behavior of the markets in the last few days, I think, is just a clear evidence that people with money on the line understand that it's faulty.
I'm confused by something. I cannot understand that if the point overall, this arcing point they're saying is we want to put people back to work and help them, especially help the working class Americans, you start taking away their safety net, and then you're going to see more people needing public support, not less. So it works against their very statements in the media.
Well, it's obvious that none of the people in positions to influence the outcome of economic policy at the moment are in the least bit interested in solving this little problem of 9% unemployment. There were no serious proposals on the table to do that. A little talk from time to time to remind the public that people are aware of the problem, this is not where the focus of policy is. The focus of policy, and particularly of this new junta, we might call it the cat food junta, that has been established in the debt ceiling deal, will be to produce cuts in Social Security and Medicare. That's what it's going to be about. And the way the default mechanisms have been set up, the fail-safe mechanisms have been set up in that process, the entire power of the Pentagon and the defense lobby will be brought to bear with the argument that if you don't cut Social Security and Medicare, we're going to have dreadful, unacceptable cuts in national defense. So the political pressure has really been designed, and I think in a very clever way, in a way that's almost likely to be very nearly irresistible, to force the Congress into doing what so far has been successfully resisted, namely reducing Social Security benefits and cutting back on access to health care.
Final question. Let's say that they succeed, and let's say that enough Democrats go along with Obama and acquiesce to the Republican mandates. What do you imagine is going to happen when they ultimately make these cuts and they have no one else they can blame for the problems that are persisting? Where do we go then?
Oh, we'll get a new round of snake oil economics that the right wing, I think, is preparing its fallback position, which will be to abandon all of this talk about deficits and come up with some new massive reduction in upper-end taxes. I think that's where policy will go next. I think they'll have a strong argument. They'll say everything else has been tried. Why not try this? And they'll remind people that in the 1980s this was done, and that the results certainly in retrospect look good compared to what we're doing now. So it would be nice to believe that we would get kind of practical attention to the actual problems we have, including jobs and the foreclosure crisis and the deterioration of our infrastructure, the need to rebuild the country, energy, climate change, all the things that are the issues that actually confront us. But I think it's fair to say we won't, because there isn't in either party a leadership that wants to go in that direction. The Democratic Party leadership is following the financial sector's line, talking only about deficit reduction. People in the Democratic Party who would like to resist that line are there, and they are speaking up, but they are basically overwhelmed, and they don't have the financial basis to mount an effective resistance. And people in the Republican Party are, playing the two sides of the street. On one hand, cuts in public spending, and on the other hand, cuts in taxes.
Once again, I appreciate very much you being on and sharing with us your insights.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Professor James Galbraith, University of Texas at Austin, giving us his perspective on this. I'll share just a few thoughts of my own on this, and that is that I see this from a completely different perspective than most. If we are trying to do two things simultaneously, if we're trying to stop massive spending, that can be done. But we shouldn't be taking any money away from the poor, especially Social Security, because Social Security is self-funding. It is not in deficit. And there's enough money in Social Security for the next 40 years. And what do you do as a society when you have told the poor, the children, those who are in need, that you no longer are sensitive to their needs? So on the one hand, we have a lot of people professing to be strong religious Christians, and I would say, well, if you are a religious Christian, what policy would Christ implement if you had to listen to him? Would he say, cast out the poor, cut out their food stamps, cut out their programs, reduce how much they're making per hour, make them live like Barbara Ehrenreich did for a period of time on nickels and dimes, working at the lowest possible wages? What would you do? What do you think the outcome of that is? Just increasing those people who are struggling and sacrificing? So if you want to save money on spending, fine. Let's do it intelligently and reasonably and responsibly. Let's just ask, how much money do we actually need to spend and for which programs that would help ensure our national defense, including a war against terror? And the amount that I've been able to determine by looking at all the different agencies, which I have, by collecting all their budgets, at least those that are made public, which I have, the total is $1.32 trillion. The most I can find of systems that are currently being used or would be used is only $200 billion. Fine. Then cut $1.1 trillion from the military-industrial security complex. And then stop all of the loopholes or givebacks to the major corporations. That's another $1 trillion. Then have a single-payer coverage for all Americans who want into it, where you have no-fault insurance, health insurance, meaning no more malpractice suits, strong tort reform, so that if you're not going to be overtreated. Right now, one of the biggest expenses that no one pays attention to in the United States, neither Democrat or Republican, is how much overtreating we do in the United States. You're given x-rays you don't need. You're giving diagnostic procedures you don't need. Why? Because it's called defensive medicine. If you should sue your doctor, the doctor wants to show that every possible thing they could have done to prevent your problem was done. But 80% of that is redundant and unnecessary. Much of it is actually dangerous for you. You eliminate that. That saves $70 billion. And if you're injured, you get treated for free. And if you lost work, you are compensated to the degree that you've lost work. So you're no worse off than under the existing system, except you allow doctors who otherwise would stop practicing medicine to continue because they wouldn't have these onerous malpractice insurance. But that means tort reform. And we are absolutely forbidden to even mention tort reform in the United States. We haven't had any, and we won't have any under the current system. So the solutions are not difficult. And I agree, is something I'm sure that Professor Galbraith would have suggested. Let's go back to what we're trying to do. De-ghettoize America, we could do that. Right now, the federal, state, and local governments have millions of square foot of space that are empty. This is a part of the maddeningness of these bureaucracies, where they're indifferent to redundancy, duplication, and meaningless bureaucratic gestures. If we turned all that abandoned or unused property over to a Habitat for Humanity larger foundation that would then go in and hire local people from the communities, set up workshops, different types of guilds by master guildsmen and women who would then show people how to do masonry, electric, carpentry, and on a local level using union supervision, is something that private contractors are almost never going to do. You then instill a sense of real knowledge, survival skills, but you're rebuilding the community. Buildings suddenly become affordable housing, but not gentrified, so you can't profit from them because they're all part of this non-profit incentive to turn old abandoned lots, keep clean those up. You could clean those up with major piece of equipment and then refertilize those and have those as community gardens. You could feed millions of Americans from right inside the cities. You could solarize the rooftops. You could put in solar hot water heaters. You could have holistic assisted living centers, and you could have drug abuse counseling centers to help people who are on drugs want to get off. You could have gang counseling centers to get people out of gangs and back into being constructive in their community instead of attacking people in their community. All that could be done, and you would lower unemployment by at least 2 million people. Then you could re-green America. Again, not difficult to do. We need to do it, and you could also rebuild the infrastructure. Absolutely necessary to do, and we're not doing it. And then you help the small business person, and the small business people in the United States could easily, if given the right incentive, they could hire an additional 3 to 5 million people. We're not doing it. So what we could do, we're not. Both Democrat and Republicans are out of the loop on fixing our future. Now, here's one commentary we're going to give before we go to our calls, and then I'll come back with health and nutrition information. We have a lot of it. This is Michael Moore came out with an article, and it was a good article, and about the whole idea of what's happened with the American body politic, and Democrats should stand up and get a spine and stop taking corporate money. This is what an individual wrote in response. Quote, "Dear Michael, thank you for your latest open letter to the American public, reprinted. As always, it is very well written and right on target, except for the fact that what you urge us to do does not seem to match what you do. I refer you to your stirring exhortation near the end of your letter in which you say, quote, we need to demand that the Democrats either get a spine and stop taking corporate money or step aside, unquote. I certainly agree, but do you? I mean, compare your bold demand that Democrats shape up or else with your own behavior. There was a time not long ago when you could have made a difference, a real difference in Democratic Party performance, when you could have indeed demanded that Democrats either get a spine or stop taking corporate money or step aside. But you finked out. Do you not remember your embarrassing behavior on Bill Maher's show when you and Maher got down on your knees to beg Nader, Ralph Nader, not to run for president because it would hurt Democratic candidate John Kerry, even though the purpose of Nader's campaign was precisely to force the Democrats to, quote, get a spine? Watching you and Maher try to humiliate one of America's most important and most effective exemplars of progressive politics brings tears to my eyes. You can refresh your memory of that shameful episode by watching it on YouTube. Until you apologize to Nader for ridiculing him in public and for contributing to the Democratic Party's campaign to undermine his credibility and muffle his courageous and unwavering demand for truth and sanity in American politics, I cannot pay too much attention to what you say because it does not match what you do, a similarity you share with Barack Obama. If you and Bill Maher and Keith Olbermann and Rachel Maddow and Ed Schultz and many professed liberal celebrities like George Clooney and Clive Davis and Harry Belafonte and Oprah had used your bully pulpits and big bank accounts to support Ralph Nader or Dennis Kucinich as the only real progressives, let alone the only real Democrats, they might have got as many votes as Ross Perot did in 1992. Perhaps not a win, but would have sent a powerful message not only to the Democratic Party that it could no longer tell progressives they had nowhere else to go, no matter how much the Democrats screwed over them, but also to the American electorate that there really was another place to go, and that was a little organization that could form a third party and sweep the next election. Instead, you and all the rest of the so-called liberals joined the Democratic establishment in throwing Nader under the bus. And each year it gets worse, as the Democrats sink lower and lower in a race to please Wall Street and Big Oil and Big Pharma even more than the Republicans, so they can suck up even larger amounts of campaign money. You owe Nader a public apology for his being right about John Kerry, and right about Obama now. Otherwise, rich and famous and clever and influential as you undoubtedly are, you will be morally underwater." End quote. As you've heard me say many times, and sometimes to the confusion of those on the left or the right, our future should not be in the hands of Democrats or Republicans. It should not be in the hands of Tea Parties or extremists. It should be in the hands of conscientious Americans who want policies and programs to help us all, I mean all, no matter what your politics, your religion, your age, your gender, your sexual preference. All people in America are human souls and deserve a quality of life and a chance at maximizing their health. Right now, neither the Republican nor the Democrats historically have provided that. I will not bear the witness of history of what Clinton did in the name of helping the unions, which destroyed much of the union base, and how he was going to help the poor by getting rid of the Glass-Steagall Act, which has caused massive poverty. Let me just say that now we do have progressives, and they're not just a few of us. If you Google conservative radio, as of this morning, it was 41 million. Liberal radio, it was 51 million. Progressive Radio, 94 million. Gee whiz, guess what's happened when the Democrats and Republicans were thinking they had the only answers? We came along. And now we have more people interested in progressive themes than the Democrats and Republicans together. Your thoughts, please. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. I'm Gary Knoll, back in a moment with the latest on health and nutrition. A little later, globalization for idiots. And who are the idiots? The Democrat and Republicans in power, and those who follow them without challenge and without looking for the truth, and what it means to the billions of people who have been adversely affected by the so-called best and brightest who've run our country and corporate America. Shame on them. A lesson in history coming at you in a moment.
Backfield in motion.
I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Knoll, broadcasting from our studio in New York City, which is going to take a substantially different look in the next week or two as our new set is being designed and built. And I hired the guy who actually designed Fox set. Not that we're going to do anything Fox does. We actually report honestly. But the work on the set, I had to like, I looked at all the sets out there and I said, here's what I want. So we've got a beautiful set being designed, and all of our broadcasters, Danny Schachter, and all of them are going to be broadcasting from a state-of-art studio. We're going to be taking your calls, the latest on health and healing right now, and then our guest and a couple thoughts from people in the studio here. For those of you who are athletic, and I hope you are, chocolate can boost your exercise endurance. This is a new study, and it says, this is in the Journal of Physiology, and it says that coca, that is the component flavanol, epicatechin, resulted in a greater endurance capacity during exercise, and that's because the component induced structural metabolic changes in the skeletal and cardiac muscles, and this was done at the University of California, San Diego. Well, what we know is there's a group of chemicals, natural chemicals, in coca that directly help your heart. And these are called flavanols, also known as flavan-3-ols or catechins. And particularly the monomeric flavanol, epicatechin. That's a class of molecules that have widespread good benefits on the body. So for those of you who take a little bit of chocolate, pure, unsweetened, no dairy chocolate, cocoa, into your pre-exercise supplement, you will have stronger heart, greater endurance, and that's what we need. The omega-3 fatty acids boost heart benefits of tomato antioxidants. This was kind of interesting. This was in the European Journal of Nutrition. It says adding the omega-3 fatty acids, which, by the way, you can use from fish or vegan sources, to an antioxidant-rich tomato juice can boost the potential heart health benefits of the juice, giving you extra energy. So what's it mean? Simply take your omega-3s and pour them into a glass of tomato juice. How simple is that, right? Easy to do. Or let's say you're doing some traditional French, Spanish, or Italian cooking where you cook your tomatoes at a low temperature. And here's the key, low enough that if you stuck your finger in the sauce, it wouldn't burn your finger. That means you're liberating the nutrients, including lycopene, so important for a man's prostate, so important for your eyes to help prevent macular degeneration and cataracts and glaucoma, so important for your brain. But now, take a little bit of omega-3 fatty acids and put it right into the sauce. A, you won't taste it, but B, it enhances boosts up the antioxidant capacity, and that's good. Something I found interesting, I was reading this on the plane coming in this morning. This is from the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Accelerated aging, meaning speeding up your aging process, is found in children of stressed mothers. Now, many of you have heard me say that don't have a child because you don't have a life. You should only, in my opinion, only have a child with intent because you want to honor life, yours and the child. So your emotional, your spiritual, your physical well-being is absolutely crucial prior to conception. And I've suggested many times to people, give yourself a minimum of a year to two to detoxify both the body and the mind. Because anything you have not resolved will come through in the energy into the developing fetus. Now there's research, and this is from Elizabeth Blackburn, Nobel Prize winner, University of California, quote, who found this, and here that the team assessed white blood cell telomeres, the length in a group of people, and this was a big study, by the way. They looked at an awful lot of people in this study. And so if you're under a lot of stress, okay, so let's say that's the ideal. But what if you're pregnant and you're under stress? I believe that we should not just have nurse midwives. I believe that we should have spiritual midwives. I'm not talking about religion now. I'm talking about spirit. What we're all born with. We're all born perfect in spirit. We're all born with a life force that is pure. It is the level and type of conditioning that either enhances and acknowledges that, allows us to utilize it, or blocks it and alters it or perverts it. In which case, then, well-intentioned people struggle to try to find what is the most important qualities in their life through the lens of someone else's belief system. So if you have perfect parents, good for you. Most do not. And so we struggle. So I'm just giving you the idea that if we had people that we could see when pregnant, they could help us resolve many of the issues, relieve that negative energy, then that negative energy would not become a part of the DNA of the developing baby who is completely innocent but takes on your trauma, your unresolved issues. The dark side of your nature becomes a part of what a child is born with. We should not burden a child at their first breath in life with all of our unresolved conflict. Just a thought. And one other thing for pregnancy, prenatal DHA, that once again, that's your omega-3 fatty acids, means fewer colds for infants, and this is published in the current Journal of Pediatrics. I'm Gary Nall. Let's say hello to Alan from Brooklyn. Alan, you're on. Your thoughts, please.
Gary, the other day or a few days ago, you had mentioned that quercetin is very good for people that have hepatitis C, and I was wondering if you could recommend a dose.
Okay. For hepatitis C, I would suggest starting in the range of 1,000 milligrams each time you take vitamin C at 2,000 milligrams 5 to 6 times a day. Thank you. Let's say hello to Don from New Jersey. Hi, Don. Don, you're on the air. Please speak up.
Hello?
Yes.
Thank you for calling out the media that's supposedly on our side for never really pushing forward candidates like Nader and Kucinich. And I also wanted to let you know, which you may know already, but your listeners may not, that there's another progressive in the House. Her name is Marcy Kaptur, and she has introduced a piece of legislation to reinstate the Glass-Steagall Act, which you mentioned. And that is probably the most effective action we could take right now, is to get our own representatives to co-sponsor this piece of legislation.
Please do this. Send me this over to progressiveradionetwork.com. We will put it up on our website. I want to know of any progressives in Congress. I want to know progressives at the state level. I want to know progressive governors, anyone who is in the media who's progressive. And by the way, don't look at non-commercial radio as being progressive. They may be liberal or they may be conservative. That does not mean they are progressive. And all the time when you hear the word progressive, it's nothing more from the right than taking anyone with a liberal position or Democrats and lumping them all together. There is a distinction that is substantial. Progressives, let me repeat this. Progressives are either people who at one time were either conservative or liberal. They can come from, or libertarian or constitutionalist or green, who saw the limitations of those beliefs, who wanted to be more independent, and wanted to see the truth of their beliefs. So often you have to accept the weaknesses, limitations, and dark side of your own body politic and those who run it simply because you're all attached at the hip to the same ideology. So the progressive is a person who first becomes independent of the hard body politic, then looks for solutions that do not exclude people. In my world, you've heard me say many times, everyone has a seat at my table. I do not exclude people. And the body politic currently automatically excludes people and condemns people who are not just like them. And the media, the left is responsible and guilty of that as the right. Why do you think that the left media is in such free fall and so few people listen to it and so few people support it? It's in chronic deficit, chronic life support. A, because it's pure radical and filled with hate and unprofessionalism, as is the right. And guess which one's growing like leaps and bounds? Progressive. Go up and go yourself. So you get me the names of people and why you feel that they're progressive, and we'll be in touch with them because we want to see people know that they're candidates who will support them. Here's what I would suggest. Please share this with those legislators. I believe that we should ban, 100% ban on all commodities that are essential to life. So you could not trade in or profit from shorting or going long on oil, water, gas, and food and currencies. Exclude that, and you've just taken away a big amount of chips on the table for Goldman Sachs, and you've allowed people then not to starve to death because the price of wheat or the price of rice or the price of water is beyond their reach. The Democrats and Republicans alike have supported pure, unmitigated greed. It's time that the Democrats grew up, became more mature, and realized you've been betrayed on every level by those you've supported, especially Obama. Thank you very much. I'll take one more. Let's say hello to Tim from New Jersey. Hi, Tim, you're on.
Hi, Gary.
Hi.
Great to hear you, Gary. One mention I thought was worthy of bringing up is that I contacted the webmaster with information to contact the governor in New Jersey to urge him to ban the fracking. Good. And that information should be on the website by now.
I just got in an hour ago. Jason's in studio. Jason, do you have that information?
We have the New Jersey Council for Fracking. We have put that up. That was last week, I think.
Okay.
27th.
We have a whole page, a whole front page of on fracking and dozens of articles of why fracking is bad and the truth about fracking. And I wanted people to go to, well, we got what, over 10,000 on our Facebook.
Oh yeah, it's 10,000 between Facebook Progressive and Gary Null. It's right on the homepage of GaryNull.com.
Fracking.
Huge.
And what's wrong? So this way, anyone who wants to support anti-fracking, which I support anti-fracking, then you can share this with the governor of New Jersey and the governor of Pennsylvania and the governor of New York. Let them know the truth. Thank you very much. I appreciate your calls. Joining me in studio is Jason. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Gary. Just quickly, I got some people calling and emailing me about seeing you in New York, California, at these premieres for Knocking on the Devil's Door. And they've seen you all over the last few days, and they were just wondering how you could keep up with this schedule the last few days.
It's not difficult as long as I don't get distracted. I don't look at a computer. I don't answer a cell phone. I went on Friday, just to give you an idea, Friday night, 6 o'clock, the premiere of Knocking on the Devil's Door. Thank you all for coming. A wonderful group of people, packed house, did a Q&A afterwards. Immediately ran over to a political party of a person who's wanting to take a Wiener's place to see what her platform was, went in and spoke with those people, and then ran downtown to David Boulay to film on vegetarian cooking by Master Chef and showing it's happening now, then ran back to the second premiere, came back to the office, got out to Denver, on a quick flight, premiered two new PBS shows, which are hard-hitting, on one on cancer, and then flew from there right into L.A. We did four premieres that afternoon, a lecture for a group of people at a church out there, a mission, and poor people. Then went into, then we were now at midnights, and then did four yesterday, and then flew back this morning. I'm going to be at both premieres tonight.
Sorry.
I'm knocking on the devil's door, and tomorrow night, and finishing Friday. We're all sold out. However, there's always no shows. So if you want to see Knocking on the Devil's Door, Nuclear Legacy, please just show up tonight and pay at the box office. Just wait in line. There are always going to be people who don't show up. Always. And I'll be doing a Q&A after each one of these. And I'm not going to get into our big worldwide movement. I'm expecting 5 million progressives to join me. How about that?
Amazing.
In 1 hour on the 21st of September. We won't get into that now, but we're getting it all ready to close down the nuclear facilities worldwide. And the nuclear people are all over the place. They're everywhere I go, they're there. Now, they couldn't have just shown up. This is not a coincidence. So they're hiring actors and people and legislators to push their pro-nuclear positions. But we are an enormous group of people coming to close down the nuclear facilities. We have the scientists. I won't go into what we're doing, but it's happening. And now I just want people to become aware. Right now it's just education. For the next 3 weeks, educate yourself on the facts. Look at the articles against nuclear. We have a whole website filled with them. So there's no reason for anyone not to know the truth. Thank you.
No, thank you.
Oh, by the way, let's see. We need a driver. We need a driver tonight, tomorrow, and Thursday night, because I got to be jumping. I'm filming tonight in between, so I got two more filmings to do on poor people downtown.
So let me just get my number really quick. Yeah. Please call me at 646-926-5428 if you're interested today, tomorrow, and Thursday.
Good, thank you.
Thank you, Richard.
Polonesky, one of our senior producers and the head of all of our documentary films here. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Gary. Gary, one to the first, let all the listeners know that for all Gary Null listeners, there's a special treat for the summer that's going to be coming up, and we'll have more to
next
discuss
week.
With that.
Don't mention what it is, though.
Oh, sure.
But this is our way here in this office of thanking all of you who recently supported the station. We've taken it upon ourselves to do something that you're going to have a ball. It's going to be so much fun, and it's going to be free. So let's mention it tomorrow when we have time, all right?
Sure.
Okay.
Absolutely.
That'll be tomorrow.
Absolutely.
Now, today, you're upstairs, as you've been for the last 4 months, editing with Corey, Poverty, Inc.
Right.
The new invisible in America. I'm going to be filming at the end of next week down on the Gulf. Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana, Northern Florida. And anyone in that area who has had adverse health effects from the Gulf spill, please let Richard know. I want to film anyone who has had the effect, because I'm going to show in a new documentary that we're going to have up very quickly in another month. And it's going to go right up on our website. Because right now, instead of opening like we're doing now in New York and L.A., we're going to do direct-to-website documentaries. So we can get the information out, calls to action, what you can do about it. And so if you know anyone, any groups, any individuals, or yourself who are sick because of the Gulf of Mexico British Petroleum spill, see, it's out of our news cycle, so we think everything's fine, there is no problem. Wrong. Give me your number, please.
Sure. Please call 646-926-5422, 646-926-5422.
In addition, Richard, you gave me a list of people you still want to film for our Poverty, Inc., Cornel West and some other people. I want to film some people in the New York area. I want to film this weekend, this Sunday. I've set aside to film people who are really struggling, who before weren't. I want to film some people in their homes and the changes and challenges they're now facing. Just regular people. I want to get their story from the New York area, New York, New Jersey area. If you are one of those people who would like your story told, please call Richard Polonesky to be included in the filming this Sunday for the final filming on our feature film, Poverty, Inc.
And also you can reach us on Facebook at Gary Null, because we've been putting up some posts and people have been getting in touch with us that have unfortunately had some bad financial situations, but they have been reaching out to us. So please contact us, Richard, or through Facebook.
Okay, good. Thank you. Thank you, fellas. And don't forget, tonight, all night, on our sister station, KPFK in Los Angeles, where I just was out there for the last couple of days, and I'll be doing my six-hour show. Let's go over and say hello to my guest who's standing by now. He is Eric Wahlberg. I gave you his background earlier. He is a journalist, scholar, who is known internationally for his in-depth investigations in the socio-politics of the Middle East and Central Asia and Russia. And as I mentioned, he lived in the former Soviet Union and is familiar with what goes on in Uzbekistan as a United Nations advisor. And he's the author of Postmodern Imperialism. Nice to have you with us today.
Hello, Gary. Nice to be with you.
First, I'd like for you to discuss globalization. For those who know the term, do not know its implications, who's involved, and why we should be concerned about it. So when you take an honest look at everything that's going on, the great gamesmanship that has historically occurred, from classical imperialism between competing empires like the United Kingdom and Russia and France, vying for territory and resources in Central Asia, to the Cold War alliances, and to the postmodern imperialism, where we're at today. Could you take us through a historical review so we know what has happened, who's been involved, and the consequences of those actions?
I'd be happy to, Gary. Perhaps I could just, for listeners, clarify these terms, modern, postmodern. Modern and postmodern are generally associated with cultural studies, modern being the larger-in-life themes of revolution and war that dominated the 20th century. Postmodern refers to the burnt-out situation of culture today. There are no more revolutions, there's no heroes, there are no epic novels, rather there's deconstruction of words and ideas. Think Derrida or John Cage or Thomas Pynchon. And the ideas, ideologies and grand narratives are passé. So modern, think of Picasso's Guernica, the idea of revolution and fighting for social justice. Now we think in terms of drones dropped anonymously on civilians as part of some nebulous war on terrorism. So that's the, I use the term kind of ironically, because there's nothing post about imperialism today. It's very, very brutal and very, very much everywhere in the world, just as it was in the first great game, the game that Great Britain was playing to try and maintain world hegemony. Now, you mentioned also globalization. Well, globalization is nothing new. Once you had steamships and telegraph, you have globalization. There was no place in the world that was not accessible to British warships 100 years ago or 130 years ago. Now we have you could say it's a deeper, it's a more aggressive globalization, which it tries to not only control territories, but to establish exchange rates, to use monetary mechanisms to take the place of war. You can bankrupt a country and reduce it to famine, as a place like Somalia. We could talk about instances and how the U.S.'s actions actually create the crises around the world as part of its drive for world hegemony.
Well, today, it is the power of money and the control of finances that fuels virtually all policies with complete disregard to the populations and its opinions. And this is a fundamental characteristic of modern globalization, which has succeeded through corporate economic influences and national and international banks and financiers. And draw the connection between economic globalization, particularly in our escapades in the Middle East, and our imperial militaristic desires to dominate and support the financial elites to control the wealth of these nations.
Yes, the banks really are the bad guys very much in this whole epic story of imperialism. And, of course, you go too far and just say the Rothschilds control our minds. I mean, that is a reductio ad absurdum. There's no absolute conspiracy going on here. What there is a logic that is derives out of capitalism. Lenin identified it quite well, and Hilferding, and in the turn of the century, they identified the financial institutions as becoming international, central banks, and then funds that were are partially monetary, non-banking financial intermediaries, which are, we talk about the shadow banking today. These are the quasi-banks that lurk in the behind the scenes, which are actually larger in their trade and in their financial flows than the bank, than the above board banking system. So again, there's nothing new to this. This was happening in the late 19th century, but again, it's a deeper process. Computers are much faster than telegraphs. Also, when you introduce flexible exchange rates, when you introduce when government controls over banking are discarded, as Clinton did during his presidency, and allowing these shadow banks to now operate, and banks themselves to operate in a shadowy way with their various credit default swaps. All of this reflects the increasing control that the bankers have over the local politics. I refer, there's two laws that I really put together that my whole book is based on. One is give me control over the currency and I care not who makes the policy. This, of course, is Mayor Rothschild writing in the early 19th century. And the other law is Karl Clausewitz's war is the continuation of politics by other means. So if you put these two together, it's a very simple logical conclusion. Bankers result in war. Banker control result in war. So that's where we are today, and my hope is that by putting together this clear logic for people, that it will help focus even policymakers onto how to get out of this dead end that we've arrived at.
Eric, I appreciate that overview. I would look at it possibly a little differently, and let me share my thoughts, and then I'd like for you to critique my thoughts, please.
Mm-hmm.
I see this in a very simplistic manner, and that is that every time we start a war, we do so because we want something from the country that we have gone to war with. Such as Iraq, it was gas. In Afghanistan, it's the routes for gas and special minerals there. And also it serves our interest in a geopolitical manner. In Libya, it is because the oil, one of the largest, if not the largest, oil reserves in Africa outside of Nigeria. And each of these countries that we're engaged in, there's something there. We're not there to serve the interest of the people, to bring democracy and freedom, because we have supported the military dictatorships, including Gaddafi, and in Syria, and in Bahrain, and all these others. So we've got to get all beyond this, and everywhere else in the world, they're beyond the idea that America, oh, is going to do the right thing. We haven't. Now, when you look at how do you control a country? First, you have to demonize something about the country or someone running the country. Then you have to bring in the military. And then behind the military is this gigantic industry that all profits off of it. And then when they're established, they never de-establish themselves. These are places that become permanent. And we now have over 1,100 permanent bases around the world. The largest embassy in the world is in Iraq. Why in the world would we have the largest embassy in the world, costing over $700 million to build, in Iraq? Because it serves economic purpose. And yet this has been not challenged by the mainstream media. The mainstream media, embedded media, has refused to acknowledge our imperial overreach, the real reason that we're in all these conflicts. At the same time, I see that our absolute blood sport in America, and the making everyone who fights in this war superheroes, and making anyone that we kill, including innocent civilians, unfortunate friendly fire casualties. At the same time, we bankrupt the public. We have spent over $3 trillion in our conflicts in Afghanistan and Iraq, and subsequent expenditures will come to another $2 trillion. So now we have bankrupted America, $5 trillion, yet we're not allowed to touch it. It's not on the table. Democrats and Republicans say, yeah, we'll reduce the military budget over the next 10 years by about maybe a couple hundred billion dollars, which is nothing, because they keep increasing it at 7 to 10% per year. So on the one hand, we have become such a warlike, war-making nation, so aggressive, so hostile, that we refuse to see that on the one hand, 17 million American children go to bed hungry. We have schools closing. We have people losing benefits. We have people working at McDonald's who used to have a gainful wage. And today, we'll do anything, no matter how absurd it is, to keep money going into this military-industrial expedition, which means imperialism, which means we're doing it for a small elite group of people's interest. Your thoughts, please.
Yes, there's definitely lots of truth in what you're saying, but you're emphasizing purely economic interests as the primary motivating force, say, in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Libya, whereas I would look more to the geopolitical, the fact that these are strategic countries in terms of controlling, less so Libya, but Afghanistan and Iraq are key countries in controlling the so-called Silk Road that is now revived, meaning the Eurasian heartland. I introduced these geopolitical terms, heartland. The U.S. is a kind of rimland. In a sense, it is distant from Eurasia, and it is an island, a very large island, but it tries to surround the heartland and to control it. And there, Israel is part of that strategy, which started in the first great game. The British promoted the idea of a Jewish state in the Middle East as an extension of the imperial project. Of course, it's become something very different. It's morphed into a very different situation today. But that was the original logic of geopolitics. There really was no economic rationale to putting, say, a Jewish state in the Middle East. And there really is not any rationale to invading Iraq to take control of the oil, because the oil companies had full access to Iraq's oil, even Libya's oil, especially in the last 10 years since Gaddafi opened up. Also, Afghanistan is not all that resource-rich in comparison. It's more a strategic location in terms of surrounding Russia, in terms of getting access to the gas from Central Asia.
I agree. That's why I said it's for the gas routes.
It's for the gas routes,
that's
yes.
Gas routes. But also, I would look at this from this perspective. I don't believe that we have the intelligence or expertise ever to understand the geopolitics on the ground. In Libya, there are over 2,000 local tribes.
Mm-hmm.
These tribes have very long and intricate relationships.
Mm-hmm.
We don't look at it that way. We look at, let's get a group of people, we'll fund them secretly, then we'll fund them, and then we'll intercede on their behalf with NATO, and then we'll, days, didn't Obama say days, not even weeks, that we would have this expedition over, and the Libyan people be free? The Libyan people right now, many of those tribes are now aligning themselves with Gaddafi, unfortunately. Well, gee whiz, did we see this in Vietnam? Did we not understand the path out loud? Did we not understand the tribes in Vietnam at the time? No, we didn't understand it. We just thought as long as we did carpet bombing and that we would win. We've done the same thing in Iraq. Do you think there's any geopolitics in Afghanistan which is totally corrupt, in Iraq that is totally corrupt, where loyalties change, where nothing is certain? So you start dealing in geopolitics, you've just stepped on a landmine. Your thoughts, please.
Well, definitely it's a landmine. A lot of people are stepping on landmines these days in the wake of American intervention. It's a great tragedy. In the case of Iraq or you mentioned Libya as well. Well, there really is this. We have to look back at the old games, particularly the second game against Russia as the enemy, communism. We needed this enemy, and it became a straw man. It became a whipping dog. It became an irrational focus on which we projected our own internal domestic conflicts. Russia, as a Soviet Union, was never an aggressive enemy threatening to war on the West. It was always the reverse, that the West was attacking and threatening to undermine it, and eventually it succeeded. Now, the same situation is going on in Iraq. What do these Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya have in common? That they were demonized as the current enemy, whether out of as Muslim or just as opposition to the imperial project. So any of these countries that try and have an independent policy, it's quite possible to have an independent policy and still trade with the oil companies, still have a peaceful foreign policy, but the U.S. does not recognize that. If you want to avoid American invasion, you have to acquiesce to the American imperial project. And none of those three countries did. They had independent policies and governments, and as a result, they were demonized, and it's very much a so-called clash of civilizations. It's an attempt to these cliches to end an end of history. It's an attempt to end any opposition to the imperial project, any cultural opposition to imperialism.
So I would agree with. I agree that the World Trade Organization and the Democrats who support it and Republicans who support it, the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, have been responsible for more human suffering than any other plight in the world except for the Second World War in the last 50 years.
Uh-huh.
The way they have held up corrupt dictatorships, they have enriched the wealthiest like Papa Doc Duvalier and Baby Doc Duvalier and groups all over the world, and were anti-union. They caused hit teams to assassinate progressives or those who are working for the poor in the interests of women in these countries. And the globalization, you to understand it, you have to look at who those who suffer because of it. And if you start at that level, in Haiti, people used to be food sufficient. They were poor, but food sufficient. In came the World Trade Organization, where Bill Clinton wanted to make Haiti the new Taiwan.
The same with Somalia.
Yes, the same. I agree. And in doing that, suddenly in comes cheap rice from America, from Texas and Arizona, that was cheaper than what the people in Haiti could grow their own rice. Therefore, why grow rice when you can get it at half the price being brought in under these special loans and these food agricultural programs? And that was the destruction of the Haitian economy. That blueprint had been used all over the world time and again. Clinton at least had the distinction of acknowledging that not long ago. So I'm looking at the world we live in today, and I'm just asking, would the American people feel any differently about their politicians and their parties if they were living in any of these countries and had to undergo the suffering and the privations from privatization of water, oil, food, education, transportation, roads, that the people in those countries have had to suffer from, and they've done so in a way that's outside of the media. The media has never highlighted the downside of globalization. The New York Times, the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, the Chandler family, they have all been pro-globalization, pro-neoliberalism, and I'm saying this is the worst thing that could happen. One little final thought. Where the United States had a very aggressive straw dog approach to the Soviet Union, the Soviet Union also was very aggressive and kept 12 of its member states in total control, used repressive tactics, and engaged in terrorism itself against dissent. And though they could brag about having free education and free health care and a quality education, except for a lot of political indoctrination along the way, you never saw the 7 million elite Russian Politburo members standing in lines for 6 hours to get a loaf of bread, or food stores that had no food. They were always well fed. They had all the things of pleasure they could have. So they engaged in the same type of globalization policies as Americans.
Quick rebuttal there, because in fact, the elite in the Soviet Union was far, far less privileged than the elite today in the post-Soviet Union. The elite
It's a different type.
Sold out. And also,
unfortunately, we will have another conversation on this, Eric. I didn't mean to argue with you. I just want having friends who are high up in the Soviet political movement, as I have and I'm sure you have, what people went through during the Soviet regime, and I've done a lot of shows on this, and what has happened post-Soviet power collapse and the new oligarchs and the new extremes, is we have to distinguish between those to have a reasonable discussion. I'm only too happy to have you share your thoughts on that since you've lived there, and I would appreciate the insights you could give us from your living there.
Okay, let's make our next discussion, we'll focus on Great Game 2, because that's where my heart is. It's a great tragedy, that whole period, and the things that we lost, the possibility for a peaceful future that was just thrown into the dustbin of history as Reagan.
Well, you know who one of the architects of the post-Soviet collapse 1991-92 campaign was? It was Lawrence Summers.
Oh, yes.
And Lawrence Summers and the Harvard elite economist got together with the richest and powerful corporation leaders in America who wanted to go into Russia, and they started the economic shock doctrine.
Yeah.
And as a result, over 90% of the Russian public who weren't engaged in politics, they were just normal people trying to survive, they got creamed.
Had the wool pulled over their eyes.
They
were
sure
expecting
did.
A positive help from the West, and they were shafted.
And the American public has never heard the true story of how much suffering occurred because of them, and then later suffered because of George Soros shorting the ruble. We'll talk about that on another show.
Great. Nice talking to you, Gary.
Eric Wahlberg, my guest and the author of a very important work called Postmodern Imperialism. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you very much for listening. Look forward to seeing a lot of you in the two showings tonight of Knocking on the Devil's Door at the IFC Theater at 3rd and 6th Avenue. Have a nice day, everyone.
Gary Knoll Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matthew Bogart. All shows are archived by Kyle Pollard. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride. And the program director is Jason Tabenfeld.